content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Maureen McDonald from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2019 Walter Magazine. We begin with a locals department. Life of Service, Veteran and Gardener Betsy Hutchinson, by Catherine Poole. Betsy Hutchinson waves goodbye from the balcony of her third-floor apartment inside her retirement community in Five Points. Waving back, her granddaughter Anne Wine says that Hutchinson always comes out on the balcony to see her visitors off safely. At 99, she's still living her life in service to others. Hutchinson was born Betsy Dana in 1920, the second of six children, and was raised on a farm in Newport, Ohio. She didn't envision a life on the farm for herself. She wanted to care for people. Hutchinson entered nursing school at St. Joseph's Hospital in Parkersburg, Virginia, and the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor during her second year of training. She felt the call to serve and volunteered for the Army when she graduated, commissioned to a second lieutenant. With the shortage of American nurses at the start of World War II, Hutchinson was quickly deployed and served as a private duty nurse at the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia, which was converted into a hospital during the war. Hutchinson also cared for Italian prisoners of war at Camp Atterbury in Indiana. And in 1943, she was assigned to the 49th Field Hospital in Torquay, England, a seaside town across the English Channel from Normandy, France. Hutchinson was in Torquay on D-Day, and the memory still evokes strong emotions for her. We stepped out of our tent that morning and looked up. The sky was black with planes. I will never forget the sound of those drones, she says. Towards the end of the war, she accepted an invitation for a blind date with a private who was serving in the Northern Theatre headquarters in London. The two hit it off, and after a six-month courtship, she married Gray Hutchinson. Actually, I think we were married about three times, Betsy Hutchinson says, recalling the many celebrations that followed once they returned to the United States. The newlyweds spent many of the final months of the war apart. While her husband remained in London, Betsy Hutchinson was sent to a hospital in Paris to care for soldiers injured in the Battle of the Bulge. After the war, the Hutchinsons were stationed together in Frankfurt, Germany, where they celebrated their first wedding anniversary. They returned to the United States in 1946 and eventually settled in Raleigh's Hayes-Barton neighborhood in 1950. It was at this home, a gathering spot for friends and neighbors, where the couple raised three children and where Betsy Hutchinson cultivated a love of gardening. In 1956, she co-founded the Green Thumb Garden Club. Although she has since moved away from her prized rose garden, she's still an active member of the club, which meets once a month for special programs, speakers, and community outreach. She eventually gave up nursing as an occupation, but Betsy Hutchinson devoted her life to care for others. If you are a nurse, you take care of everyone. It's the greatest profession in the world, she says. Betsy Hutchinson has been a member of the Samuel Johnson chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution, DAR, since 1947 and received the DAR Community Service Award in 2016. A stone bench was dedicated to honor her service in World War II at the Oakwood Cemetery Field of Honor. She's also a longtime member of White Memorial Presbyterian Church, a former Boy Scout leader, and a faithful supporter of many community organizations, including Step Up Ministries, and through her garden club, the Frankie Lemon School. A life well lived Betsy Hutchinson still keeps moving. While she downsized from the family home in 2012, more than a decade after her husband passed away, she continues to open her door to visitors, former neighbors, church friends, and a family that includes 7 grandchildren and 7 great-grandchildren. She takes a flex and stretch class 3 times a week and arranges flowers every other week in her community's dining room. "I keep busy," she says, which may account for the fact that she can still fit into her captain's uniform. Granddaughter Anne Hine concurs, "She has something going on about every day. I tried to schedule lunch recently, and she was too busy." Betsy Hutchinson interjects, "Well, that's the secret. I believe you have to stay involved. That's what I've done." Next, from the Givers Department, "An Appetite for Words, Read and Feed Provides Meals and Mentoring to Local Youth," by Addie Ladner. You may have noticed an RV parked in neighborhoods across Wake County with a picture of a cheeseburger sandwiched between 2 books on the exterior. No, it's not an extra quirky family heading out of town. That camper is actually one of local nonprofit Read and Feed's Classroom on Wheels. Founded in 2007 by Wake County school volunteer Jan France, the Read and Feed RVs park in low-income neighborhoods to deliver the gifts of words and warm meals to over 600 children annually. France came up with the idea for a mobile classroom when she noticed that many of the kids she tutored couldn't access after-school resources due to transportation issues. Those issues were keeping their literacy skills from improving as they should. And what's more, those kids were often from low-income families, struggling to put food on the table. Her solution? Go to the kids. Jan essentially created a mobile classroom. She noticed that these children were coming from the working poor, and so she decided to feed them too, says Katie Mullen, executive director at Read and Feed. The need for a program like Read and Feed in Wake County is great. Last year, over 58% of Wake County's low-income third graders failed to read at grade level, and nearly 40% of elementary school-age children are on low or reduced prices lunches. Teachers refer students to the program who are identified as at risk for falling below grade-level reading or who are in need of tutoring. There's a direct correlation between children who are low income and children who are not reading at grade level, says Mullen. Read and Feed's impact aims to put a dent in those numbers. Mullen credits the organization's success to the hundreds of volunteers, community sponsors, and fellow nonprofits who support their mission. Many of the Read and Feed sites are in food deserts, and groups like Interfaith Food Shuttle work with them at most sites to provide healthy meals, such as roast chicken, green beans, and fresh fruit to the children. Each RV has been outfitted as a playful, comfortable, and engaging classroom for up to 24 children at a time, and Mullen says the children love spending time in the RVs. Step into one of the newly redesigned 2011 Fleetwood Bounders, and it's easy to see why. Chalkboard paint covers the cabinet doors, and brightly colored Dr. Seuss quotes decorate the walls. The RV bedrooms serve as mini libraries, filled with books for kids to check out, and each RV has a dollar store-style nook where kids can pick out trinkets as a reward for their reading progress. However, Read and Feed is much more than just a classroom and cafeteria, says Mullen. I had a social worker tell me it's more than positive reinforcement. You walk in and understand that it's a safe place, she says. The one-hour sessions cover a lot of ground. Each child receives a meal and tutoring, followed by a progress report to track reading skills. The children check out books from the organization's own little library that holds 15,000 titles and are often given books to keep for good. Read and Feed wants not just their instructional reading skills to thrive, but their independent reading skills also. They want them to be able to read out loud. The idea is not silent reading, it's engaging the children in conversation, says Mullen. The organization is always looking for more volunteers, and Mullen credits these individuals for the organization's success. To tutor these students, one just needs a passion and interest in helping to give kids an appetite for reading, she says. While Read and Feed's main mission is to strengthen literacy skills in children, Mullen has observed their power is much larger. We're much more than a nutrition and literacy and reading program. We're mentoring and nurturing. Next up, Digging Deeper by Ayn Monique Klar. Dr. Lindsay Zano takes us beyond the glass walls of the Museum of Natural Sciences Paleontology Research Lab. You've probably gotten a peek into the Paleontology Research Lab inside the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Its walls, after all, are made of glass. From the outside, you can see the quiet bustle of researchers and grad students chipping away, literally, at its ancient fossils. That's all fascinating on its face, but if you're lucky enough to step inside, like we did, you'll realize that, much like any excavation site, what you see is just a hint of what you'll find beneath the surface, or in this case, beyond the walls. Dr. Lindsay Zano is the head of the paleontology lab, where she supervises about 6 staffers and students at any given time, in addition to teaching at NC State University. Zano was brought on in 2012 to raise the visibility of the research going on at the NCMNS, and she made a big splash this past February when she announced the discovery of a new dinosaur, Moros intrepidus, named the Harbinger of Death, because the tiny tyrannosaur helps bridge the fossil gap between the smaller dinosaurs of the Jurassic period and super predators of the Cretaceous period. The fossils that led to the discovery are on display at the front of the lab for all to see, the fruit of more than 7 years of excavation and research after she first spotted the bones at a site in Utah. I love the field work, the adventure and excitement of finding something new, says Zano. Inside the lab, there are about 25 research projects going on right now. Front and center, you see oviraptorosaur eggs that are being excavated. Once that's done, the eggs will be sent to NC State for a CAT scan to see if anything is still preserved inside. In the middle of the room is a giant triceratops skull, still encased in a protective jacket that Zano found in Montana in 2016. I'd been walking for hours and really didn't want to go down this hill, so I decided to stand there and just look. And I saw something, just about 6 inches of fossil sticking out. As we kept digging, we realized it was a paleontologist's dream, she says. It took 2 years to get the permits and fully excavate the nearly intact skull. Then they used a helicopter to airlift the 1,400-pound fossil back to civilization. Deeper inside the lab is office space. Here, Zano and her team write up research and grant applications, study specimens, create models, and more. The most hidden part of the lab is in the basement. That's where all the fossils are stored, more than 4 million specimens that have been discovered or sent in by others. Once they receive a fossil, they're obligated to store it in perpetuity. While they can't loan anything out, they invite other researchers to use their collections. Because, Zano says, while the fieldwork is exciting, the best part comes once the research is done. I love the moment of discovery when all the data goes through. And we meet another local in Tall Tales. Benji Shelton serves Mexican-inspired cuisine on Person Street by Charles Upchurch. The first thing Benji Shelton told me was a lie. I'd walked over to his boho Mexican cocina and bar, Gringo Agogo, from my office downtown. Never met him before. Stopped by on a Monday when the place was closed to ask about doing a short write-up for this magazine. He scrunched up his face behind his glasses, his graying hair a mop. "I'm really boring," he said. "Uh-huh. You've seen Gringo on the corner of Edenton and Person Streets. The 1930s-era mission-style service station was converted to a pocket-sized neighborhood cantina on the edge of Oakwood, with fiesta lights strung about, hammered metal cacti sprouting, and a funky little vintage car parked outside. It's a 48 Crosley. This is the work of an artist. Inside, Shelton serves up what some say is the best Mexican comfort food in town. Always local, organic whenever possible, great-tasting vegan options, and fresh-squeezed juices that elevate the margaritas to rare levels of thank you, Jesus. All in a footprint with room for just 10 tables, and 10 more outside, and a design motif that leans toward, how did that Yelper put it? Slacker cowpunk meets Pee-wee's Playhouse. Boring? Please. Shelton is an iconoclast. This is the guy that created Lily's Pizza in 1992, giving 5 points an invigorating dose of underground cool. After high school in Lucia, North Carolina, a speck outside Charlotte, Shelton moved to Raleigh in the early 80s as one of the original members of the rock outfit Corrosion of Conformity. He was known in music circles, sang and played in various bands, and briefly served as road manager for pop stalwarts the Connells. With Lily's, Shelton found an outlet for his creative mojo. The place boomed. He even turned down an offer from a major restaurant chain to buy it. Eventually, though, the hours took a toll. After 6.5 years, he sold it. Then he ghosted. Shelton bugged out to the small mountain village of Almolonga in the Mexican state of Guerrero, 4 hours south of Mexico City. 80 degrees every day, 60 every night. Something to eat on every tree, he said. Most Americans wouldn't live there. No mail service, no phone, but every day, just magnificent. It was here that he fell in love with simple, home-cooked Mexican food like pozole, chilaquiles, and tortas. It was a good life for the expatriate farmer with 16 hectares of land and a smattering of cows, herding them to the high pastures in the morning and back down at sunset. I would have lived there for the rest of my life, but it became too dangerous, Shelton says. I knew the heroin epidemic was coming when they started growing poppies everywhere. During his years in Mexico, Shelton devised different ways to make a living, usually involving making pickup runs stateside. He bought sneakers from discounters in the U.S., loaded down his van, and returned to Mexico. I made a lot of money selling Air Jordans, he said. In summer, he would drive to Nantucket Island and run an ice cream truck for 10 weeks before making the 3,100-mile drive back. Once, He made the return trip in the same truck loaded with bicycles to give away in Almolonga. "I had 'em hanging off the side," he said with a smile. "It looked like the Beverly Hillbillies." By 2012, the cartels were moving in. "I had to leave in a hurry," says Shelton. Back in Raleigh, he began looking for a place to open a humble Mexican cafe. Since opening in 2014, Gringo A Go-Go has gained a diverse clientele, intermingling downtown progressives and Jones Street conservatives. "They open up to me," he said. "I could tell you tales." Tales indeed, like ones of clandestine junkets to Cuba to liberate vintage motorcycles. It has been, as the former punk rocker describes it, a creative life. "I tried painting, I tried being a sculptor," he said, gesturing around the room. "This is my sculpture." Shelton may not be in Raleigh for long. He talks about South America. Suriname and Guyana are on his short list. Still, he admits to the occasional twinkling of bliss when he thinks about this creation at 100 North Person Street. "I remember once on a spring night, patio lights up, flowers in bloom, people eating and drinking and happy," he said. "It really felt, in that moment, like nirvana." True story. Next up, Larry Wheeler rubs elbows with a style icon in An Afternoon with Audrey. Once upon a time, Audrey Hepburn came to Cleveland, Ohio. She was there to raise money for UNICEF, for which she was an international ambassador. Even in a city known for its arts, which routinely brought great celebrities into the mix, entertaining Audrey Hepburn was a big deal. Hepburn was a movie star extraordinaire and style icon. The bewitching lead of Breakfast at Tiffany's, Sabrina, and other landmark films of the 1950s and 60s, the face of French haute couture house Givenchy. I, however, knew her as a friend, sort of, if spending several hours looking at art with her counts. Lucky me. How did this happen? It was February 1991, and all of Cleveland was itching to rub elbows with Hepburn. The opportunities were few and the prices were high. There was a smallish and pricey cocktail party at the Historical Society on Friday night. I, however, was not among the well-heeled guests. But I did attend the focal event planned for Saturday evening in the huge ballroom at the Stouffer Hotel, which could accommodate hundreds of paying guests. Burton Wolfe, a close friend and theater producer, had been hired a couple of years earlier as special projects director for UNICEF. These galas were his gig. At the time, I was the assistant director at the Cleveland Museum of Art. In return for sharing the names of generous art patrons and arranging venues to show children's UNICEF art from around the world, my husband Don Dosky and I were invited as his guests. Wow, what a special evening. Ms. Hepburn made a speech, to be sure, but she spent the biggest part of the evening strolling around, approaching every table and thrilling every guest she touched. What was she wearing? I think it was a floor-length white sheath, but I can't be sure. Maybe that was in the movies. I do know that she was stunning in the most natural way. Her gracious manner was disarming. Classic classy was Audrey Hepburn. We were all starstruck. The next morning, Wolf called. "Ms. Hepburn and Robert would like for you to guide them through the art museum tomorrow." Robert, being Robert Walters, her romantic companion for the last 9 years of her life, the museum being my Cleveland Museum of Art. "No way," I replied emphatically. But I insisted that Evan Turner, the esteemed museum director, lead the tour, Otherwise, I might be out of a job. Please let them know we're thrilled to have them. On that Monday, Turner and I awaited the pair. The entrance to the Cleveland Museum is framed by a brutalist porte-cochere designed by the internationally renowned architect Marcel Breuer. It's a rather austere welcoming point for one of the greatest art collections in the world. The Cleveland collection, assembled by connoisseurs, ranges from the rarest of antiquities through masterpieces of Europe and the Americas to exciting work of the present day. Cleveland's Asian collections are at the top. No wonder Hepburn wanted to take a look inside. Hepburn and Walders arrived in a black town car. She wore black slacks and a cream-colored cashmere top. He, an elegantly tailored blue blazer. I introduced the pair to Turner. After curtsies all around, off we went. Walders was particularly interested in seeing the Japanese collection, which Sherman Lee, the previous director, had shaped into one of the best in the world. Hepburn was interested in the Guelf Treasury, priceless medieval sculptures, recent works by Jasper Johns and Anselm Kiefer, just about everything. Turner wowed them with his backstories and history lessons. The museum was closed to the public on Mondays, so we had the galleries to ourselves, almost. Dozens of staff milled about nonchalantly to steal a glimpse, as you can imagine. Nevertheless, Hepburn and Walders were the most exquisite guests. They exclaimed about the quality and rarity of the works in the collection. Their questions were intelligent and probing. Sophisticated and charming were they. At the appointed hour, the tour was done, and they were off to their next appearance. They left us breathless beneath our smiles. Within 2 years of that happy day, Hepburn died of colon cancer. Walders died last year. And yet, Audrey Hepburn is immortal. She is and always will be a constant frame of reference for style, grace, and generosity of spirit. I'm grateful that for several hours in 1991, I was blessed to be wrapped in her magic. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.